From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with drama critic Richard Gilman. His memoir, Faith, Sex, and Mystery, shows another side of his life, how he became a lapsed Jewish atheist Catholic. Also today, I talk with New York-based comic Reno. She's nostalgic about the days when safe sex meant doing it when your parents weren't home. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward profiles the Buzzcocks, an early punk group that he says were more influential in England than more popular bands such as the Sex Pistols. And book critic John Leonard reviews The Year of the Barricades, David Coates' panoramic view of the protests of 1968. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest is theater and literary critic Richard Gilman. He's written a memoir about a side of life even many of his friends didn't know about, his conversion from Judaism to atheism to Catholicism to what he now calls a near-total state of disbelief. His memoir is titled Faith, Sex, Mystery. He says that he came into the church because of death and left it because of sex. Gilman converted to Catholicism in 1953 at the age of 28. 8 years later, he left the church, concluding it held no place for him, either sexually or intellectually. Although it has been 25 years since his deconversion, the issues that brought him into the church remain important to him. Richard Gilman has been a theater critic for Commonweal, the Catholic literary magazine, and Newsweek. He's past president of PEN, the Society of Writers, and is now a professor at the Yale School of Drama. His earlier books include The Making of Modern Drama, Decadence, and The Confusion of Realms. Richard Gilman, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Did your initial attraction to religion baffle many of your secular friends?
No, not really. I had grown up, or at least from college on, had as most of my friends, people who were looking for something, questing, you know. And as I say in the book, I at one time or another was a Freudian, a Marxist, a D.H. Laurentian, you know, all kinds of things. And while religion was not, to be a formally a member of a religion, a formal believer was not the in thing at the time. It didn't baffle anybody among the people I knew. What would have baffled most of them had they known later, and some of course did, was that I would do anything serious about it. You know, to be interested in religion is one thing; to become religious is another.
You were born into Judaism. When you became religious, how come you didn't become a religious Jew?
Well, as I say in the book, I had a perfunctory Jewish upbringing. You know, I went to Hebrew school and I was bar mitzvahed and went to synagogue on the holy days. My mother and father were, I would say, perfunctory, nominal Jews. My grandparents were quite religious. But I didn't grow up in a religious home at all, and I never really learned anything about Judaism as a religion. Essentially, what it was a tribal reality. And I never was interested in it as a religious thing, and it slipped away from me very quickly once I was bar mitzvah and reached 14, 15, at which point I declared myself a very adamant atheist, which was partly a political stance, you know, at the time. But for the next 10 years or so, I investigated passionately every kind of system of belief. I was looking for something.
What did you find in Catholicism that you didn't find in other places?
Well, I found truth, what I considered to be truth. There is a very strange, well, not so strange, something has happened in questions of intellect and questions of value. Probably for the last couple of hundred years, which is that the truth of a proposition or of an idea isn't the crucial thing. The relevance of it is. And I was convinced through a rather lengthy and arduous process of thought and experience, as I describe in the book, that Catholic claims to be the repository of truth in the very basic sense were justified. I joined the church essentially not for sentimental reasons, certainly not for emotional reasons, essentially for on the basis of the fact that once I saw something as true, it seemed to me that I had to act on it. It took me a long time, as you remember from the book.
One of the things you write about very candidly in the book is your mixed feelings about certain sexual fantasies that you had, a very kind of slight masochistic type of fantasy that you had. Did you experience guilt about that, and did that feed into your wanting to enter the church?
I had, when I was growing up, when I was in my teens and early 20s and so forth, the world was rather different. Society was rather quite different. There are things that I felt guilty about and ashamed of that would scarcely make anyone ashamed or guilty today. You know, I had certain fetishes. I had certain tastes in, you know, in women. I admired strong, aggressive women. The kind of thing which certainly didn't hurt anybody. I felt guilty essentially because I grew up in an era when a great many things were taboo and were not discussed and were not permitted. And my father was a particular Puritan, as I say, touch on in the book. I had a very difficult time reconciling my sexual nature with the church's commandments. But that difficulty, I think, would have been the same whatever my sexual proclivities were. For example, I have gotten a number of letters from gay people, mostly gay men, one or two women also, who've read my book and who tell me that they're very grateful that someone has come out and candidly talked about sexual difficulties in relation to moral commandments or religious commandments. And while my particular situation was not theirs, they appreciated that sort of thing in my book. And that meant a lot to me.
Well, actually, sex had a lot to do with your leaving the church, but
exactly.
I want to come back to that in a few minutes.
Sure.
Let's talk a little bit more about your entry into the church.
Yeah.
Now, you were brought up in a Jewish household. It wasn't a very religious Jewish household, but still, I mean, certainly it was a secular Jewish household.
Yes.
Many Jews are really uncomfortable around Christian religious practices.
Sure.
And I wonder what it was like for you to enter church for the first time as a converted Catholic, knowing what your parents would have thought.
Oh, sure. Oh, it was very difficult. I grew up with, I would guess, sharing a very widespread feeling of suspicion, fear, hatred, you know, of what my family called, and, you know, in that my milieu, was called the goy or the Gentile or, you know, the others. And as I talk again in the book, there were certain images that were very oppressive to me. The church itself, physical churches, nuns, for example, that whom I thought were sort of black apparitions from some dark area, priests, certain words that troubled me greatly. Oh, I had to overcome a great deal before I could actually, you know, go into the church. As I say in the book, too, what was very fortunate for me, I think, was that when I actually was baptized, I was out in Colorado Springs, and I started to go to a very small Mexican-American church, a very simple church, in which almost all the parishioners were Mexican-Americans and generally a lot of old women. Some couple of quite gentle priests. The whole feeling there was far simpler and far less involved with the kinds of images and practices that I had that had disturbed me before. So I sort of slipped in a better way than it might have been elsewhere. But I did have a great deal to overcome in my mind. I there's a line I think in the book where I talk about the presences that sat or moved in my mind, images, words. To which I had very reflexive responses of coming from a very early age.
Theater and literary critic Richard Gilman is my guest. He's written a memoir titled Faith, Sex, Mystery. Converts are in a unique position. Usually people in a religion share a cultural past with the people who they come to pray with. But when you're a convert, you don't have that shared past. You're brand new
exactly
to this
right.
tradition. Did you feel like you were
sticking
out and
yes,
different?
Yes, I felt Well, there were two kinds of feelings I had. One was that I had slipped in and it didn't matter where I came from. Because when I did become a Catholic, I almost immediately went to the extreme left, if you want to call it that, of Catholicism. Politically, socially, I started to write for a magazine on the left. I got associated with things like Dorothy Day's Catholic Worker, that kind of thing. A liberal Catholicism, you can call it that, which was a big help to me because I had always had that feeling about the church that a lot of people have, liberals, had that the church stood for reaction, fascism, you know, that sort of thing. There were times when I felt like an interloper. I felt like I didn't belong. And I had that sense of not having shared in the background. But part of that was that I didn't share in the ethnic background because it's not easy to separate ethnic realities from religious ones. For example, growing up in an Italian family or a Polish family or an Irish family. So that I saw it as a question of both ethnic difference and religious difference. But at the peak of my belief, and that, it lasted, for some years, which is to say when I was believing fervently and practicing ardently, the spiritual realities transcended any sense of social dislocation.
Do you remember the first time you accepted communion and what that felt like?
Yes, I described it. I always had difficulty with communion. The question of the wafer being the body and blood of Christ, the whole phenomenon of transubstantiation. I had difficulty with it. I knew it was a central, crucial element of Catholic practice. And I remember watching the people go before I took communion. I used to go to church and sit in the back and watch, before I was actually baptized. And I would watch them and I would see, and they looked very peculiar as though they were all, many of them looked like they were sleepwalking and others looked like they had just experienced some very grave event. And I found it very difficult to think that I could do that. Anyway, I finally went up to the altar. It was in this church, little church in Colorado Springs. And opened my mouth and accepted the wafer and must have been in a kind of catatonia because I don't remember how I felt. I remember walking back to my seat in the pew and swallowing the wafer and wondering what I had done. I never quite could accept the thing. I accepted the practice. I could never quite get over the sense of the mystery, and I suppose it eventually, of course, is a mystery of what it was that it did. I know that there was a gap between my rational perception of the thing, taking communion and my actual experience of it.
During the first part of your stay in the church as a converted Catholic, you were feeling you were getting a lot from it. When you were getting the most from it,
yes.
what was it you were getting?
Well, I was getting a sense of priorities. I was getting a sense of being, well, I described it as being carried by updrafts of grace, of being sustained by a reality beyond myself, greater than myself, all those kinds of things. I felt that my will was supported. I could will effectively. I could act the way I thought I should act. It's the only period of my life, and this lasted several years, in which I felt that my whole being, my psychic, my intellectual, my emotional selves were cohesive and moving together, and that didn't last, but it was there for a while.
You felt that integrated, but were you able to tell your parents that you converted?
I never told my parents, and I explain again in the book why. My parents were not Orthodox Jews. They were not very religious Jews, but they were very psychologically Jewish. And I didn't have a good relation with my father. But apart from that, I felt that there was no point in my telling them. They would not have understood. They would have felt offended. They would have felt affronted. They would have just about exploded or fainted or something, and I felt that there was not much point in telling them. I didn't believe then, and I don't believe now, in the primary virtue of what that fashionable word, sincerity. We should be sincere, you know. Sincerity hides a lot of spiritual pride. It hides a lot of arrogance and so on. I saw no reason for hurting them, and I saw no gain or value in that kind of sincerity in telling them. They suspected, they knew, when, especially when I started writing for a Catholic magazine called Jubilee, and then later Commonwealth.
A clue.
They must have had some. I told them that these magazines did employ some non-Catholic writers, but I think they were so happy that I finally had a job, because I had not had a job. I was drifting through my 20s as what I used to call an intellectual bum or hobo. And so they were so pleased that I finally had a job that I think they would have swallowed anything. But in any case, I didn't tell them.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back in a few seconds. My guest is Richard Gilman. He's a drama and literary critic. We're talking about the subject of his new memoir, Faith, Sex, Mystery. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
Richard Gilman is my guest. We're discussing his memoir, Faith, Sex, Mystery, about his conversion from Judaism to atheism to Catholicism to what he now calls a near total state of unbelief. Richard Gilman is a professor at the Yale School of Drama. Let's talk about your falling out with the religion. I think one of the things you found most frustrating was the church's view of sex and contending with your own sexual desires. Could you, for instance, accept masturbation as a sin? This was not a concept you were used to.
I could accept it as a sin because it had been presented to me in a secular way as a kind of crime. In other words, something you were not supposed to do.
Sure, because a lot of children were always told you'd either get pimples or
I was told something really terrible would happen to me.
Exactly,
my mother was filled with threats that something really awful would happen to me. I accepted it as a sin, but I had trouble with it even there. I had trouble always reconciling the sexual aspects, well, the aspects of what are gathered under the rubric, the title lust, sins of the flesh, you know, lust. I think that obviously sexual sins are for many Catholics and much of the church as an institution and for many religions the most serious, the prime sin, and I don't think so. I've never thought so. I think that sexual sins can, for example, formal sexual sins, sins of lust, can have in them love, they can have in them generosity, they can have in them compassion and a sense of humanity, a sense of mortality and so on. In other words, they can have virtues in them that other sins like gluttony or avarice or cruelty, you know, do not have. And the church's emphasis, which is what I encountered, I think it has changed, I would imagine, certainly in the United States, changed for the better. It's not nearly as monolithic as it once was. Hence the American church's quarrel with the Vatican over things like abortion, you know, that sort of thing. The greatest trouble I had was to deal with what I thought of as the inflexibility, the abstract condemnation of certain acts which I felt needed to be seen in a more supple, a more complex way, and a more compassionate way.
We keep quoting St. Augustine as saying, God, send me chastity, but not yet.
Yes.
But I get the feeling that in your own life, you didn't want to have to totally sacrifice the flesh in order to find spirituality.
Exactly. I thought I should, in a way, not sacrifice completely, but for example, I was married much of that time, and I had problems with my wife. I had on an occasion I would go outside marriage, and you know, in other words, commit what was be called technically class adultery. I felt that my particular sexuality would be even more difficult for the church to accommodate. I remember thinking of Jesus sitting up on his throne in heaven and rolling his eyes in shock and horror at my particular fantasies, which of course is an absurd notion. But as I said before, I think no matter what my sexuality was, it would have come into conflict with you know, with the church. And that's the kind of response I've gotten from a lot of people who've written me, you know, about the book, that they experienced much of the same thing.
Well, I think for a lot of people who are religious or slightly religious, the conflict comes up between sexuality and religion, mm-hmm. or between some other belief or passion that they have in religion. And the question becomes, do you stay and fight off your impulses,
yes.
or do you accept your impulses and leave the religious institution?
Yes, of course, that's the question. There was another aspect of my quarrel or battle with the church, and that was what I do call my ambition or my ambitiousness. When I came in the church, I felt a great relief from the burden of selfness, you know, burden of ambition, the burden of competitiveness, the feeling that I want to make a place for myself in the world. I was very ambitious, and I had quite a time, I was very content to sort of labor anonymously. Not worry about making a name for myself. And then gradually, as I got into my 30s, and I had literary ambitions and had them, which I'd squelched, which I'd simply suppressed in myself. And I know it was a kind of foolish dichotomy that I, or opposition that I erected there. I was taking the admonition to be humble and, you know, and to efface myself quite literally. And even though I consciously knew and was told by people I knew at the time that there was nothing irreligious or sinful in developing my talents, you know, and gaining a reputation, I felt guilty over that. And finally, the ambition, the suppressed literary desires broke through, and I began to feel that this humility that I'd had before was pretty false.
What do you even talk about? A self-aggrandizing kind of humility.
Yeah. Now, you see, I still think this is something that touches on a great many things. You pointed out at the beginning of the book, you quoted the idea that I do not have any real belief today. I still have some. I have a faint, more than faint, it's there. Some kind of, for example, I'm not an atheist. I believe in God. I don't know how or what. But one thing that I got from the church, from the essence of the church, the best part of the church, was a sense of something to combat the fierce, cannibalistic almost, you know, competitiveness of our time, which is gaining all the time, the aggression, the greed, the putting of the self first, which we phenomena we see all around us, you know, and it seems to grow all the time. I remember feeling that only through this kind of principle of at least partial self-effacement or generosity, a sense of giving to others, could you combat that. What seemed to be the tide of the times, you know, the tremendous individualism, the dog-eat-dog, the man is a wolf to man, and all of that, which I felt then and see even more strongly now.
So you believe in God in a kind of, but that's where the mystery comes in. It's not, you're
yes.
not part of an organized religion
no,
right now.
No, I don't go to church. I don't know if I ever will go back. I didn't write the book in order to go back, you know. And yet I find stirrings of various kinds.
Well, I want to ask you about art,
yeah.
too. I mean, because one of the things you've really struggled with throughout most of your adult life are questions of religion. You've also struggled with questions of art, and I'm sure there's some connection there for you. Because let me remind our listeners that you're a literary critic, you're a drama critic, you've been writing almost all of your adult life, and you were a passionate reader even when you were a child.
Yes. Well, I think it's true to say that for me, for a long time, and to a certain extent now, not nearly as strongly, art was a kind of religion. And I think that was true and has been true for a lot of people. I think less now, but it certainly was true. It began to be true probably a couple of hundred years ago. And I think it developed in the 19th century. And in our time, and particularly with what we call modernism, the sense of art as a way of belief, a way of dealing with experience, literature particularly, but the other arts too, was this kind of substitute religion or a pseudo or quasi-religious experience. Though I think that there is a strong connection of a very fundamentally good kind between art and religion, I think, because both deal with the impalpable, both deal with realms of reality beyond the immediately provable, beyond the scientific, beyond the ascertainable. There's a remark that I'm very fond of quoting. I always quote it to my students by the French writer Charles Peguy, who described what he called the bourgeois mind, and by bourgeois he didn't mean necessarily any economic level, a kind of mind, he said, that always and inevitably prefers the visible to the invisible. And I think that art, in a way, and religion in its way, offers the invisible as a kind of alternative to the palpable, the known, the visible.
Well, you know, in that connection between art and religion, many religions use art in a way to for as part of the religious experience through hymns and songs and paintings and iconography
and cathedrals,
literature.
And there was, of course, a time in human history in which art and religion were very closely united, fused almost.
You know, I want to ask you one last thing. You almost apologize to your readers at the end of your memoir for giving them nothing definitive, no calls to order, no models for behavior, no moral resting place. But it seems to me that finally that's what your experience is about. It's about continually questing for some kind of answers to big questions, but not finding pat answers.
Right. Well, I think that came... I had the sense and perhaps I was silly to worry about this, but I have a feeling that in books of this kind, this, the broad genre, people are looking for some kind of answer, and of course they get very cheap ones, you know, from lots of people. Some kind of thing, now I'm this, and now I'm that, and by implication, this is what you should be, and this is what you might do, and so forth. I came out with no conclusion. I am still, as I said, peddling in midair. I have no answers. And it's interesting that a number of letters that I've gotten from people have told me that that's fine, it's all right, they didn't want me to, you know, that it would have been false if I'd come out with some denouement, you know, some final conclusion and saying, this is it, this is the truth. I don't know.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you very much for sharing some of your experiences with us today. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much for having me.
Richard Gilman's latest book is Faith, Sex, Mystery. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Ninochka Rosca. For years, she worked as a journalist in the Philippines. She was imprisoned by the Marcos government, then she went into political exile in the United States. She returned to the Philippines just as Marcos was losing power. She chronicled that time in a book titled Endgame. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, I talk with Reno, a stand-up comic who lampoons the schizophrenia of big city life, especially as it relates to sex and sexual politics. Also, rock and roll historian Ed Ward examines the legacy of the Buzzcocks, one of the first British punk bands. And book critic John Leonard reviews The Year of the Barricades, a journey through 1968. Journalist and historian David Coates' examination of the year it seemed the whole world was marching in protest. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Dale Willman in Washington. As President Reagan lobbied undecided lawmakers for more aid to the Nicaraguan Contra rebels and prepared for his nationally broadcast address tonight, Secretary of State George Shultz testified before the House Foreign Affairs Committee today. On the eve of a House vote on $36 million in new assistance, Shultz said the money is needed to keep the peace process going.
I think it is apparent, myself, that we have, as I said, that we have got to where we have gotten by virtue of the combination of pressures and negotiations that have been gone through.
Three of the four major television networks have decided not to air President Reagan's address. It will be televised live only by the cable news network. ABC, CBS, and NBC officials say they will not air the address because the president will be making points about Contra aid that he's made before. Two gunmen wearing ski masks invaded a private school in Tuscaloosa, Alabama this morning, taking a teacher and at least 60 children hostage. One of the men detailed a series of complaints against the government and demanded to see the town's mayor. Mayor Al DuPont met twice with the men, and one of them surrendered 4 hours after the siege began. Some of the children have also been released. The U.S. Postal Service's governing board today named Anthony Frank as the nation's 69th Postmaster General. Frank is chairman and chief executive officer of the First Nationwide Bank. He takes over the postal job March 1st, replacing Preston Tisch, who's returning to private business. Frank is the fourth Postmaster General in 4 years. He says he plans to stay in the job 3 to 5 years. More illegal aliens are being arrested at the border crossing between San Diego, California, and Tijuana, Mexico. That increase comes despite a downturn in attempts to illegally enter the U.S. at other border crossings. NPR's Celeste Wesson reports.
Border Patrol officials say that nearly 54,000 people were arrested near San Diego last month. That's almost as many as in January 1986, before the new immigration law. The new law is supposed to discourage illegal immigration by imposing fines and jail terms against employers who hire undocumented workers. Last year, arrests at the border dropped by nearly one-third. Immigration officials said that was evidence that the law was working. But the new figures show that arrests at the nation's busiest border went back up by 13% last month. Immigration officials say that may mean that word is spreading south of the border that some employers are still looking for illegal workers and that the rumors of mass deportations from the United States were false. Officials also caution that the increase in arrests may not continue next month, pointing out that arrests at other border points have not gone back up. I'm Celeste Wesson in Los Angeles.
Punxsutawney Phil, Pennsylvania's famous groundhog, today predicted an early spring.
He has failed to see his shadow. Yeah!
Jim Means is the president of the Punxsutawney Groundhog Club. Phil's counterpart in Sun Prairie, Wisconsin, Jimmy the Groundhog, saw his shadow and went back to sleep, predicting 6 more weeks of winter. Further signs of an economic downturn today. The Commerce Department reports that the index of leading indicators fell 0.2% in December. It's the third straight monthly decline. The Commerce Department also reported a sharp 6.2% decline in home sales in December. The economic news out of Washington today pushed several major banks to cut their prime rate, the benchmark rate of interest, down to 8.5%. The Securities and Exchange Commission today said that computerized trading did not cause the October stock market drop, but had an indirect negative effect on the market. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 8 points to close at 1952.92. Advances led declines 4-3 in trading of 164 million shares. I'm Dale Wilma, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward has a profile of a British punk group called the Buzzcocks. They were popular for only about 4 years, in the late 70s and early 80s, but they haven't been forgotten.
It's funny, but when you talk to British musicians who grew up during the punk explosion of 1976, you don't hear the Sex Pistols mentioned much, nor do many people credit the Clash with being an inspiration. The Pistols were like the Monkees, one musician told me recently. We knew they were made up. But of the big names from that era, there is one that everybody seems to remember with affection and reverence, the Buzzcocks. This might be because, unlike the Sex Pistols and the Clash, the Buzzcocks weren't from London. They were from grimy Manchester, far to the north, a city everybody disdained. But when they scraped their money together to make a four-song record called Spiral Scratch, they became overnight heroes. As soon as you heard the first song on Spiral Scratch, Boredom, you knew this was something new. The Pistols just yelled over the noise they made, and the Clash had more enthusiasm than skill at first, but the Buzzcocks seemed to have found a way to put together melody, tension, and good old pop hooks in a way that anybody could appreciate. Their original vocalist, Howard Devoto, left right after Spiral Scratch to form a terribly pretentious band, Magazine. But Buzzcocks co-founder Pete Shelley took the opportunity to write some great songs like I Don't Mind.
Reality's a dream, a game in which I seem to never find out.
And balancing Shelley out was the band's other guitarist, Steve Diggle, whose songs like Autonomy were a bit more abrasive and angular.
In 1979, the band was beginning to make world-class records like Ever Fallen in Love.
American record labels refused to release a Buzzcocks album, thanks to the fear of punk, which had firmly set in by then. Punk? That was a laugh. A record like Everybody's Happy Nowadays sounds like a classic track from the 60s, maybe a sort of jam session between the Kinks and the Who. 1980, the Buzzcocks released one last single, Harmony in My Head, written by Steve Diggle, and then they dissolved. I was lucky. I got to see them once on what must have been their only visit to the West Coast, so I know why a folk singer like Billy Bragg gets so upset over the remake of Ever Fallen in Love that the Fine Young Cannibals recorded in 1986. I know why they inspired a huge and diverse scene to spring up in Manchester, and I know why a songwriter I interviewed recently said, "The Buzzcocks, man, they were the only band that mattered."
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle.
Love is a dream, life's an illusion. Love is the dream, life's the illusion. Love is a dream, life's the illusion. Love is the dream. Everybody's having a blast. Everybody's having a
This is Fresh Air. While a lot of comics are making jokes about safe subjects, Reno jokes about safe sex and how so many of her friends are dying of AIDS.
It's ridiculous. All my friends are dying. You know, I don't know what to do. You know, I have one of these address books that every year you've got to change it, you know, because it's also a day-to-day book. So every year I got to change it. I don't know what to do with the dead friends. You can't, like, just leave them out. That's kind of cold, right? So I figure, okay, move them to the next one. But they don't have, like, phone numbers anymore. They're just kind of, like, some of them might still have phone numbers. You know, they left the little answering announcement, you know. No one ever calls you back anyway. What the hell, you know. And then I'm thinking, okay, well, maybe I could just put them, you know, integrate them into my alive friends and put, like, a cross next to them. So you know how they do it in the literary places. But, of course, my friends are not Christian, so I'm not going to put a cross next to them. You know, maybe I'll put a T, a little symbol of T next to them.
A lot of Reno's material is about sexual politics. Because her subjects are so potent and controversial, she first worked performance spaces and has gradually begun to make her way into the more mainstream comedy clubs. Before she started doing stand-up, she performed with underground theater groups and toured with Lilith Women's Theater. I spoke with Reno about her comic style and asked her if she ever felt uncomfortable talking about AIDS in her stand-up routine. She told me that even years ago she was talking about AIDS in her performances.
I noticed that a lot of the gay men did not know about AIDS. They, you know, and I had known about AIDS since pretty much the first patient, it seemed, since about 1980, I think. And I couldn't believe it, you know. And so I thought, well, I'll do this bit. And people all, you know, laugh and also are in dismay about it. I mean, you got to confront it. I mean, the entire world has changed because of it.
Well, you even talk about having so many friends dying and...
Oh, that piece. Oh, yeah, that's intense, that piece. You're right. Yeah, not knowing whether to transfer my dead friend's names into my new address book every year because I have one that you have to change year by year. Yeah, there are some audiences that really relate to that because everybody's had so many people to die that have died over the last couple of years. There are other audiences that you just couldn't bother. I mean, I had an audience that... just plain safe sex talk meant nothing to them. I had a week in Albany, and in fact, I was fired from the week because they said that no one knew what the, you know, they couldn't care less about what I was talking about. I mean, you know, I was talking about, probably I was talking about heroin and condoms and things that I kind of relate to, and these folks weren't, and the owner of the club said, you know, I'll pay you for the rest of the week, and I respect you for what you're doing, but my audience is, you know, they would rather talk about the supermarket.
So is this going to force you to tone down your material?
No. Mm-mm. No. I'm just, frankly, I'm content with a long view. I feel that it's going to take me, and it has taken me, a while. And it's going to continue to take me a while, but I'm not generic, and I never will be. Not that I'm trying not to be. It's just not me. I don't watch TV. I don't really have the time. It never occurs to me to watch TV. I'm not going to do parodies of television programs because it's bogus. It doesn't matter. I don't care to do that. I'd rather, you know, perform once a year. It's okay with me. And the money stuff, well, right now, you know, I'm really, really broke, but so what? It'll get better. And I don't, you know, I don't have any desire to get laughs off of the, you know, the sweat of somebody else or, you know, how a person looks or whatever is some of the, you know.
One of the things you seem to do is improvise a lot, improvise for real when you're on stage,
mm-hmm.
at least in the performance spaces.
Mm-hmm.
That's a risky thing because it's not necessarily going to be funny every
mm-hmm.
time when you take a chance when you improvise.
Right.
You've probably learned by now what is the worst thing that can happen if you take that chance and it doesn't work. So what's the worst thing that can happen, and have you experienced it yet, and has that given you the courage to just keep trying it?
Well, I don't know. I guess it hasn't happened. I suppose the worst thing that could happen was that, you know, they stand up screaming, saying, "You're disgustingly not funny. You're making us sick. Could you get the heck off the stage?" That hasn't happened yet. But sure, I've fallen in front of people. I haven't made things connect. You know, it's mostly out of a lack of confidence. I mean, if I let myself, I mean, I can trust, I think, by now, I should be able to trust that what I'm going to say is not going to be, you know, racist or horrific towards anyone. And if it doesn't make people laugh, well, you know, that's, to me, not a crime. And so when I can get that kind of real self-acceptance, then it doesn't matter what the heck I do because people are going to be with you because people like confidence. It makes them feel comfortable. And if we can just let go of the critic inside, meaning also you jumping inside the audience's head and saying, "Oh my God, she's awful," oh my God, you know, and all the chatter that you think is going on in their mind, then, you know, I can just fly.
You do the kind of act that I could imagine your mother being very uncomfortable with. Have you ever performed with your parents around?
Well, I have a funny parent kind of situation, and without bothering to go into the weirdness of it, no, they have never even asked what I'm doing, let alone come to a performance. I went to their house for an hour on Christmas, right? And I mentioned to my mother that there had been this lovely article written about me this week in the Village Voice. And did she want to see it? And, you know, she never responded. And at one point towards the last 10 minutes I was there, she said, "What's that on the floor?" And I said, "Well, that's that article I was mentioning, Ma." And she said, "Well, we'll pick it up. Your father just vacuumed." You know? So.
I get it.
Yeah.
Did you ever go through a period of just wanting to perform in front of women?
No.
Because I know some women do.
Yeah, no. I really like eclectic. I like the world, you know. But in other words, what I'm trying to say is that I like talking with and, you know, for anybody. I mean, I do subway humor.
Subway humor?
You know what I mean. I'll do shtick in the subway because people look so darn glum. I'll just do some, you know, one of the simpler things I remember a couple of nights ago is, you know, the subway driver or the rails or something, some combination of both, made it seem like we were in the big kahuna, you know, like, let's go surfing now. So I started acting like I was surfing, you know, and I was taking a tumble and stuff. People were hysterical. And people who weren't even looking at each other and who, if they were, they were looking with steaming glances. They just lightened up. Everything was great. I love that. It's my favorite thing to do. I tell you, if I could, you know, make a living, I almost wanted, well, I don't want to say this over the air because somebody will steal the idea. I wanted to write a grant for the National Endowment that I'll do humor on the streets of New York, you know, 20 hours a week.
You know, I bet it would be a good way of protecting yourself because people would think that you were crazy and nobody would mug you.
Oh, honey, that's so funny. Terry, I have a bit like that.
Do you really?
Mm-hmm. I have a bit like that. Oh,
No, no, tell me about it.
Oh, yeah, well, let me think. It's something like this guy came up to me and he's like right straight in my face. And he says to me, "Oh, baby, you are looking so beautiful tonight." And I look at myself, I said, "What are you, kidding me? My pants don't fit. My hair is grown out. My cat's upstairs. She's coughing. I don't know. Does she have feline leukemia or something? What do you think that is? He's like down the block by this point. Right? Okay, baby, we'll see you later. I discovered a rape deterrent. You know, you don't. You're afraid of what somebody's going to do to you in New York. You just tell them what's going on with you. People don't won't hurt you if you're acting crazy, I suppose.
You're pretty much an original. Do you feel like you have any models at all?
Well, there was the battleship Regalia. No. Yeah. Models. People I love.
Who?
Lily, of course.
Uh-huh.
Lily Tomlin. I once made her laugh the entire time she was handing out autographs outside of a theater I saw her at in San Francisco, and that was a big deal.
You were doing shtick while she was signing autographs?
Yeah, yeah. I was just, you know, this is way before I was in the business. Richard Pryor, I think, is brilliant. You know, I think that his homophobia is obnoxious, but that was years ago. I don't know if he's still into that now. Well, I love Bette Midler.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she doesn't really do stand-up, but she's hysterically funny, and the energy, you know, she has that sort of drag queenish, you know, core, and but all sorts of people dig her, and that's what I like. That's what I like. I mean, to see some lady with the, you know, pursed lips next to some hip-hop kid laughing at the same stuff, yeah.
Okay, well, Reno, thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, Terry.
Reno spoke with us from the NPR Bureau in New York. Her next appearance is at La Mama Experimental Theater in New York City in a program called One Night Stands. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Let's check in with host Robert Siegel. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What story are you following?
Well, we're reporting on FBI Director Sessions' defense of his bureau's spying on the group CISPAS, a group opposed to U.S. policy in Central America. He says the FBI was justified in doing that. Nina Totenberg will have a report. Koki Roberts prepares us for the speech this evening by the president in defense of Contra Aid. It'll also be a Democratic response to the president later on. And we'll hear about a man named Judah Benjamin. You know who he was?
Who?
He was the Secretary of War and Secretary of State of the Confederate States of America. Before that, the first acknowledged U.S. Jewish senator. A new biography is out.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Twenty years ago, in many parts of the world, students left their classrooms to march in political demonstrations. The Year of the Barricades is a new book by British writer David Coate that analyzes the rebellions of 1968. Book critic John Leonard has this review.
David Coate is one of those busy English journalist historians whose essential subject is the romance of the 20th century with violent revolution. On the road and in the library, he wants to know why the left went wrong. His books include The Great Fear on the domestic anti-communist campaign under Truman and Ike, The Fellow Travelers on Western intellectuals whose sympathies with Marxism brought them nothing but grief, and Under the Skin on Civil War in Rhodesia. Now, like John Cameron Swayze hopscotching the world for headlines in the early days of American TV, he goes everywhere in the bloody year of 1968, and everywhere in the affluent West, the Third World, and the Communist Bloc, the students are revolting. They are revolting in the United States, of course, at Columbia and Cornell and the Democratic Convention in Chicago, in Paris and Nanterre, at the London School of Economics, in Rome and Berlin and Madrid, but also in Tokyo and Mexico City, Warsaw and Prague, and as far away as Red Guard China. And Coate doesn't even mention Islam. Obviously, not all of these students are dupes of the Comintern, or agents of the CIA, or fundamentalist nuts. They aren't all revolting because of Vietnam, or because they feel alienated in technocratic societies and post-scarcity economies, or because their parents, with one eye on Sigmund Freud and the other on Dr. Spock, pampered them too permissively, or because Chairman Mao wanted to get his jollies. In fact, the biggest disappointment of the Year of the Barricades is that Coate can't really find a single explanation for this multiplicity of insurrections. To be sure, there was something Oedipal about them everywhere. Kill the fathers, abolish the past, pull down established authority. But why were authorities so various, all called simultaneously into question? Coates speaks just once of the epidemic factor, by which he means everybody seeing everybody else doing the same thing on television at the same time, and revolution as contagious, like rock music. But he's far more interested in exploring in detail the kinky side of the barricades, the sex and drugs of the yippies, the violent macho fantasies of SDS and the Red Brigades, the fevered idea-mongering and peculiar choreography of French and Japanese protest. All this fascinates, especially Prague, to which Coates himself was a witness. I was a witness myself to many of the American events, and he gets them right. If he makes too much of the media brats of these movements, he's surely correct to emphasize the rise of feminism and the damage done to the American left by the split-up of blacks and whites and the betrayal of student idealism by established communist parties east and west and the insufficiency of third-world revolutions and their icons as models for Western dissent. These children wanted a meaning to their lives, and they wanted it immediately. Their failure to get it depresses Coates. But aren't they still nibbling at it, around the margins of the profit motive, grown up to modesty, patience, and cunning in exile? Surely the 80s greedheads with their red suspenders won't last forever.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine, and as a columnist for New York Newsday, he reviewed The Year of the Barricades by David Coates. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow, I'll speak with cartoonist P.S. Mueller. His single-frame absurdist work appears regularly in alternative newspapers around the country. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz will review a reissue that features the Kolisch Quartet, a little-known, innovative European ensemble. And Jan-Harald Brunvand will explore the urban legend of the skiing accident. It's an improbable misadventure about a beginning skier, an expert, broken limbs, and a woman skiing backwards with her pants down. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.